Hello, everyone. My name is Susan from the Talking Information Center. Today is April 8th, 2026, and I'll be reading from the December 25, January 2026 issue of Brain and Life magazine. The first article I have for you today is titled Dynamic Duos by Robert Firpo Capiello. With the backing of shared experiences, peer mentors help patients and their loved ones face the physical and emotional challenges of neurologic disease. A stroke survivor learns to walk again after months of therapy. A person with Parkinson's tries to balance a progressive disease and medication with the desire to keep moving. A former athlete adapts to life with a spinal cord injury. For people living with neurologic conditions, recovery is neither a straight line nor a one-and-done fix, but rather an ongoing process, one filled with setbacks, small victories, and constant adjustment. In the long, uncertain middle chapters, when patients are in the thick of their illness and adapting to new ways of life, many have found a powerful ally, another person who has walked the same road. Across hospitals, clinics, and online communities, peer mentoring, pairing people navigating neurologic conditions with others who have experience with that same condition, is emerging as one of the most meaningful forms of support in neurologic care. Peer mentoring isn't a substitute for support groups. It's an additional layer of support, says Jory E. Fleischer, MD, MSCE, FAAN, a neurologist and researcher at Rush University, who studies ways to better support family caregivers of people living with Parkinson's disease and Lewy body dementia. Everyone dealing with a chronic illness needs to help in different ways. A one-on-one connection lets people ask those difficult personal questions they might hesitate to ask in a group setting. That individual relationship can make it easier to talk about sensitive issues and can help patients and caregivers gain confidence and self-advocacy skills. Jessica Roberts, MSN, FNP-C, and CEN, who coordinates peer mentoring in the stroke program at Michigan Medicine and is an adjunct clinical faculty member at the University of Michigan School of Nursing, notes that the discharge transition period is often daunting for the stroke patient and their support persons. Studies and clinical observations have highlighted gaps in emotional and practical support following hospital discharge. For patients living with the long-term effects of stroke, Parkinson's disease, multiple sclerosis, and other neurological challenges, those gaps don't close quickly. The patient has complex needs which are different from other medical diagnoses, Robert says. These range from new disabilities to emotional needs and complex medical challenges that place patients at risk of complications and readmission. Peer mentoring acts as an essential bridge, not only during this discharge transition period, but throughout their entire recovery process. That bridge works because mentors understand the terrain from the inside. Peer mentorship empowers patients to give voice to lived experiences, allowing for a patient-centered care approach during the recovery process, Robert says. Research has shown that peer support can improve patient satisfaction, mental health, and even clinical outcomes by enhancing motivation and adherence to rehabilitation. Why it works. Traditional care addresses the medical and rehabilitative needs of patients, but peer mentoring adds other dimensions, empathy, and firsthand understanding. In the simplest terms, Robert says, this is someone the patient can directly relate to. Peer mentors provide empathy, validation, and understanding from someone who has been through a similar situation. This is something clinicians without lived experience may find hard to replicate. Mentors can share strategies that make day-to-day life easier, how to organize medications, communicate with doctors, manage fatigue, or stay motivated for therapy. Connecting with a peer who has regained independence or adjusted to new challenges increases confidence, resilience, and hope for both patients and their families, Robert says, and families can benefit too. Loved ones who are also adjusting benefit from talking to others who have navigated caregiver roles. It reduces their own anxieties and feelings of isolation. T.J. Griffin, Peer and Family Support Program Coordinator for the Christopher and Dana Reeve Foundation, which the late actor and his wife established after his 1995 spinal cord injury, understands neurologic trauma firsthand. A football injury in 1990 left Griffin paralyzed from the shoulders down, forcing him to relearn even the most basic tasks, such as feeding himself. He finished high school while undergoing months of rehabilitation. I had so many emotions and questions going through my head, he recalls. I was almost as emotionally paralyzed as I was physically. But over time, that experience shaped his calling. Now in his 50s, Griffin connects newly injured people and those still struggling years into recovery with mentors who can guide, encourage, and listen. Being a peer mentor coordinator and helping other people realize their full potential has been the most rewarding experience of my life, Griffin says. Peer mentoring is critical to not only the patient, but also the caregiver. Caregivers often ask, how can I set myself and my loved one up for success? Dr. Fleischer says. Peer mentoring gives them not just emotional support, but a scaffold for learning, a framework for understanding symptoms, changes in family roles, and strategies for daily care. In Robert's work, she sees the benefits of mentorship unfold in emotional and tangible ways. When a mentor opens up to a mentee, there is a level of trust and openness that can only be fostered through shared experiences, she says. This, in turn, can lead to more honest conversations about fears, frustrations, and successes. That honesty creates space for difficult emotions. For Griffin, being a peer mentor means helping people with spinal cord injuries understand that their life is not over. It's still there for the taking. When people can say, I know exactly how that feels, it normalizes their reactions, Robert says. They can talk about frustration, grief, or anger in ways that might not feel appropriate in a clinical setting. She also has seen how peer mentoring has helped reduce anxiety and depression among patients and their loved ones. There is also enhanced hope and generally a more positive outlook on recovery, Robert says. Recovery is a process. With peer mentoring, patients tend to experience a greater acceptance of what I describe as the new normal, with support from someone who faced similar challenges. That acceptance can have measurable effects on engagement. We know that patients who are experiencing depression and anxiety after stroke tend to have decreased engagement overall, including with rehabilitation, Roberts notes. When patients have reduced depression and anxiety after connecting with a mentor, there in turn can be increased engagement in rehabilitation programs, which can improve recovery. The benefits can extend to everyday behaviors, too. People who receive mentoring experience behavioral changes, follow medical regimens better, and are better able to navigate resources, Roberts adds. Peer mentors often become role models by example rather than instruction. Seeing someone who has rebuilt their life the way Griffin did, returning to work, finding new hobbies, or redefining independence, gives patients a glimpse of what's possible. As Roberts puts it, real-life stories make recovery feel more tangible when someone can see that another person has made it through or adapted to the changes that were put before them. Evidence-based support. A growing body of research has backed up what patients and clinicians have observed anecdotally for years. Peer mentoring changes lives for the better. One of the earliest and most comprehensive studies of peer mentorship in a health setting comes from the Carpeta Roja Diabetes Program, developed by Latino Health Access in California and later adapted into the Care Companion model at WellMed Medical Group in San Antonio. A 2015 evaluation, published in Annals of Family Medicine, showed that patients with type 2 diabetes who participated in peer mentoring achieved a statistically significant improvement in blood sugar control, meaning a faster decline in HbA1c levels, compared to a control group, even though both groups received high-quality clinical care. Researchers also found that participants reported reduced isolation, stronger self-management behaviors, and a ripple effect of improved health habits among family members. While diabetes and neurologic conditions differ, the underlying principle is the same. Lived experience fosters trust, motivation, and behavioral change in ways that formal medical settings alone cannot. Another study from Ohio State University's Fisher College of Business found that patients paired with trained peer mentors experienced lower anxiety levels and faster post-operative recovery than those who received standard post-surgical support. The researchers attributed the improvement partly to shared emotional regulation, meaning when a person can relate to someone who has already succeeded in navigating recovery, they feel calmer, more confident, and more capable of doing the same. And in the neurologic community, the Parkinson's PALS pilot program has shown promising results. People with Parkinson's disease who were paired with mentors demonstrated improved quality of life scores and reported feeling less isolated. The study, published in Neurology in 2024, suggested that structured mentoring could complement physical therapy and medication by addressing the emotional and social dimensions of living with a chronic neurologic condition. In pilot studies, Dr. Fleischer observed that peer mentoring for caregivers is feasible and highly engaging. Without setting time limits, we saw mentors and mentees naturally spending about 30 to 40 minutes a week on the phone, sometimes up to 2 hours, because the conversations were meaningful. And while she expected the mentees to benefit the most, interestingly, the mentors also improved their own knowledge and coping skills. Many told us that helping others gave them perspective and helped them process their own caregiving journey, Dr. Fleischer said. Looking ahead, as research continues to validate the impact of peer mentorship, such programs are becoming more deeply woven into standard neurologic care. Hospitals have started incorporating peer mentors into discharge planning and rehabilitation teams, and digital tools have expanded access for patients who live far from major centers. Experts also foresee an expansion of caregiver mentorship. Families often bear the emotional weight of chronic illness and structured peer support can be as vital for them as for patients. Roberts believes that the future of neurologic care will increasingly recognize the wisdom of lived experience as a therapeutic asset. Loved ones benefit enormously from talking to others who have walked the same path, she says. Sometimes the most healing words are simply, "I understand." Dr. Fleischer and her fellow researchers have launched a large randomized trial funded by the National Institutes of Health that will recruit about 680 caregivers of people with Parkinson's disease and Lewy body dementia. The new trial will expand on their pilot work and place greater emphasis on the mentors themselves because they play such a vital role and benefit personally from the experience, she says. For the millions of people living with neurologic conditions and their caregivers, the peer-mentoring relationship may be as vital as any medication or therapy. The reassurance that recovery, adaptation, and even joy are not solitary pursuits, and that no one has to travel the road alone. Finding a peer mentor. Patients and caregivers should ask their neurologist or rehabilitation center whether local peer mentor programs exist. At Michigan Medicine, for example, the Stroke Peer Mentoring Program connects patients and families with trained mentors at various stages of recovery. Any member of the care team can reach out to our program to connect a patient, says Jennifer Roberts, the program coordinator and an adjunct clinical faculty member at University of Michigan School of Nursing. Our flyer is available in a patient education binder provided to all stroke and TIA patients. TIA is transient ischemic attack. Patients who are admitted to Michigan Medicine, and it's also available in the outpatient stroke clinic. Peer mentoring programs differ in structure, but the core principles are the same. Mentors are trained, confidentiality is emphasized, and the relationship is built on respect and shared experience. National programs include the American Stroke Association's Stroke Connection Program, which offers a nationwide directory of support groups and online peer connections, can be found at stroke.org. Parkinson's PALS, Peer Mentorships for People Living with Parkinson's Disease, can be found at parkinson.org. Pediatric Brain Tumor Foundation Peer-to-Peer Mentoring connects families who have lost a child or who are caring for a child in treatment. The website is curethekids.org. Christopher and Dana Reeve Foundation. This offers a robust peer mentoring program. The website is christopherreeve.org. Helen Hayes Hospital Peer Mentoring Program. This is for people with spinal cord injury. The website is helenhayeshospital.org. Kennedy Krieger Institute Center for Spinal Cord Injury. Specialized peer mentoring for patients and caregivers. The website is kennedykrieger.org. And finally, MentorEase, a digital platform that helps hospitals and nonprofits create virtual peer-to-peer networks. The website is mentorease.com. The next article is also from Brain and Life and is titled Safe Havens by Natalie Pompilio. This article is about sensory-friendly rooms that offer soothing spaces for children and adults alike. The most sensory-friendly spaces in Kim Hindery's home are tailored to her 10-year-old daughter's preferences. There's a cushioned crash pad in Abby's bedroom, since deep pressure comforts her, and one corner of the basement has all of the things she loves, including items to keep her hands busy, such as bubble wrap and fidget spinners. This isn't to say that the rest of Hendry's Cincinnati, Ohio home isn't comfortable for Abby, who has cerebral palsy, schizencephaly, and polymicrogyria. She prefers natural light, so the family doesn't often use overhead lighting, for instance, but these nooks are special oases for her. People like Abby can turn to these spaces, known as sensory rooms, when they feel overstimulated, since the rooms have less sensory input, notes Ariel Lyons Warren, MD, PhD, a neurologist at Texas Children's Hospital, whose research focuses on sensory processing disorders. Once rarely seen outside therapeutic settings, sensory rooms have popped up at schools, stadiums, playgrounds, corporate offices, amusement complexes, and even state parks. As more public venues see the value of offering these spaces, families look to create similar places at home. One thing Hendry has learned about sensory rooms is that there is no one-size-fits-all approach. You really have to hone in on what your child responds to, says Hendry, who is also executive director of the Child Neurology Foundation. There are some kids who could play with Velcro all day and find it soothing, and for others, that's like nails on a chalkboard. What can help kids move from a state of agitation to a state of calm? Benefits for many. While many associate sensory rooms with children with autism, the spaces also can benefit those with epilepsy, attention deficit, hyperactivity disorder, and mood disorder. And they're not just for children. They can help reduce stress levels in adults with dementia, post-traumatic stress disorder, brain injuries, or excessive anxiety, too. Reducing sensory input can be as easy as dimming overhead lights, painting walls a soft color, or choosing a sensory-friendly floor covering. Common aspects of many sensory rooms include items with different textures for restless hands to discover, a sound system that can reduce unwanted noises or play soft music or nature sounds, and comfortable seating. Some neurodiverse individuals prefer areas that allow them to quiet down, perhaps with weighted blankets or vests. Others need rooms that allow for movement and might be outfitted with equipment like climbing walls and swings. Sensory rooms can be as diverse as the individuals they support, Dr. Lyons Warren says, but all center around modulating sensory input to ensure the amount of light, sound, touch, taste, or smell provides support without being overwhelming. Sensory rooms can even help neurodiverse individuals when they're outside the room. Having a space where you can build up that inner battery or recharge can be very helpful, says Aaron Nelson, MD, a pediatric neurologist and professor at NYU Grossman School of Medicine. Obviously, out in the world, you can't control your environment in the same way you can in a sensory room. But you may find things like noise-canceling headphones, specific textures, or even a specific item that can be a bridge to transition from the sensory room to the outside world. Autism Speaks, a nonprofit serving people with the condition and their families, often works with businesses and organizations that don't have the resources for sensory rooms but still want to make their spaces generally more welcoming, says Ariana Esposito, BCBA, the organization's vice president of service and supports. The best way to start is by asking those with learned experience for their input, she says. Who are your guests or customers or patients? Who are the people that you're serving? Bring them along in the process, Esposito says. It's really about creating a sensory-friendly experience. Fluorescent light bulbs often emit sound that can be overstimulating for someone with sensory issues. look at things like music levels and scents that some might find overwhelming. Esposito notes that Autism Speaks offers online resources that can help, such as training that people can take to become an autism-friendly ally, and information about how businesses can earn their autism-friendly designation. Sensory rooms can benefit neurotypical individuals as well. Hindery's older daughter, 12-year-old Adabel, also enjoys the family's designated sensory-friendly spaces. I read how curb cutouts were such an advancement for the disability community because wheelchairs could get up on the sidewalk. But they're also super beneficial for the average person with luggage or a grocery rolling cart, Hindery says. When I was a teacher in a classroom, I found all of the students benefit when I turned the lights off. Kristen Mitchell, an instructor in Thomas Jefferson University's Occupational Therapy Department and director of the school's Master of Science in OT program, believes sensory-friendly spaces benefit everyone, not just people who are neurodiverse. I believe we should start normalizing the conversation about sensory rooms and sensory-friendly spaces, she says. Creating your own space. You don't need a whole room to create a sensory-friendly space either, notes Esposito, who lives in New York City, where space is often at a premium. A sensory room can be a small part of a room, such as a corner with a beanbag chair, an indoor tent, or even a closet. Dr. Mitchell has a friend who created a sensory-friendly space on the corner of her couch, outfitting it with a candle, lamp, and blanket. The key is offering a variety of items that address different senses. Esposito remembers working with an older client who, after visiting a sensory room for the first time, said, "This is the calmest I've felt in a long time. I didn't know you could have something like this. I thought it was only stress balls." Consider including items that are pleasing from a tactile point of view. Comfortable furniture, including beanbags and crash pads, weighted blankets or vests, adjustable lighting, and devices that emit sounds that the patient enjoys. Don't forget to take the different senses into account when designing the space. Sound can be tricky because it affects other people. But if your child likes sound, put things in there that make noise so they can create it, Dr. Lyons Warren says. If your child doesn't like sound, think about sound dampening or using paneling to muffle sound. Even a slight odor can be very irritating for someone with olfactory hypersensitivity, while certain odors may be calming for some children. Knowing your child's triggers so you can address them when they arise can help you determine the right setup too. When she was teaching, Hindery used the concept of ABC, antecedent, behavior, and consequence, to plan her next steps while working with children with sensory issues. If you look at what comes before and after the behavior, you can sometimes find a trigger or something that soothes a child, Hindery says. This record of how a child responds to their environment and to different sensory items can be very useful in determining what kinds of things your child needs. Outfitting a sensory space doesn't need to be expensive. Internet searches bring up tons of sensory room DIY ideas and hacks. Hindery regularly introduces Abby to new items from dollar stores that she thinks will have a calming effect, like a squishy stuffed animal. Ideally, if you have a child or adult who can engage in the process of creating a sensory room, you will want to work with them to tailor the room or experience to their needs, Dr. Nelson says. It's important that these individuals know what works best for them and how to ask for those things. From person to person, there can be a lot of individuality with regards to what's most soothing, he says. That's all the time we have for today. I'm Susan, and I thank you for listening to the senior section at the Talking Information Center.